Sorry, we're talking. Welcome back, though, to our conversation. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're online all the time at npr.org. And we're just sitting in here chatting because we got company. This is when our producers come in and we talk about what you all out there in the real universe outside the studio are thinking about, what you're reading, what you're emailing to your friends. And we talk about it in a segment we call The Most. So I guess I'm going to start.
Please do.
I'm going to tell you about where you can find the best tap water in America. I happen to take issue with the results of this. There was a competition that was held by the National Rural Water Association. This is, to clarify, this is not the best water in the country of all time. This is the best water in the country in rural places.
So not of all
places.
Time. So not like 17
cities.
Not on the list. Not of all time and place.
Okay. Does it check everybody's wells? I mean, how
yeah,
do they do
I
that?
Don't know.
Martha!
They
head down to the well.
They had a contest. They were judging the water on clarity, bouquet, and taste. And Southampton, Massachusetts was named the best tasting among samples from the nation's small town water departments. Other finalists included North Kingstown, Rhode Island, Lewis, Delaware, Lorain, Ohio, and Avila, Indiana. I would take issue with this because I think all of that is a bunch of baloney, frankly, because water in the Intermountain West is way better than any water in the Midwest.
I smell a water rivalry.
It's true.
Editorial bias here.
I'm not kidding. Yeah. It is fresh mountain spring water.
Whatever.
Where was that contest held? Did it say?
Washington.
Okay.
Where all contests are held.
Right from the eyes of a unicorn.
Well, it would seem to me that, you know, the California water was at a disadvantage. Maybe water doesn't travel well.
Oh, maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
The closer the water is, it's fresher.
Personally,
yeah,
I don't think water should have a bouquet.
Yeah.
That whole concept bothers me.
Don't you criticize wine as, quote unquote, too watery? What do you criticize water as? Man, it tastes like water.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Jeannie.
Jeannie, let's.
All right. Did you guys know that there is sex ratios between newborns is off, and it has been for 40 years in Western countries, in developed countries?
Off. How?
More girls than boys by 1,000 births a year. This is a phenomenon of recent years, and some new research out by British scientists is beginning to explain why. It turns out if mom eats a good breakfast on the day of conception, those little boy baby embryos feel encouraged to go on. And they've got a couple theories about this. One is that in rich nations, calorie-conscious moms are skipping breakfast. Maybe part of it. And the other theory is based on some evolutionary science, which is that fitness is the success of males as breeders is more closely tied to fitness than it is for girls. So the theory there goes, the little baby boy embryo, if it had a good breakfast that day, feels like it's got a good shot at being a successful breeder if it makes it all the way.
I have to say, wait a second.
Trisha doesn't buy it.
No, what I like is that it plays into the whole idea that little male sperm need encouragement.
The embryos.
Because
this is
like,
post-conception, because of course...
Yeah.
They're
course,
like mama's boys from really early on.
Oh, yeah. That's what they're theorizing.
Dan Pashman, what
hey
do you
guys,
have to
how
say
are
for
you?
Yourself?
I've got a most emailed here from Yahoo News. Lynchings in Congo as penis theft panic hits capital.
Wait a minute. Did you say lynchings?
I did.
Did you say Congo? Wait,
that's
what
right.
was the other word you said?
Just those two.
Okay.
That was it.
That's why it's pretty interesting.
Police in Congo have arrested 13 suspected sorcerers accused of using black magic to steal or shrink men's penises. Sure, blame it on the sorcerer. After a wave of panic and attempted lynchings triggered by alleged
witchcraft.
Yeah, you
laugh now. You're not being lynched or your member.
Nor
lynched.
Are you the victim of some of the sorcery. But these rumors began circulating last week in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and people are really, really freaking out. And it's kind of like old Salem witch hunt days, where there's a rumor that somebody has this ability, and suddenly the mob shows up, and a mob shows up, an angry mob, and there are problems with attempted lynchings.
But the guy making the accusation, doesn't he have to say,
he does.
I have no unit.
He does, Mike, or a much smaller one at least. And there's a quote here from A regular man on the street, Alan Kalala, in Kinshasa, he says, "It's real. Just yesterday here, there was a man who was a victim. We saw. What was left was tiny." Now, the police chief says he's not really having it. He says he thinks it's a joke, or it's a joke to him. He says, quote, "When you try to tell the victims that their penises are still there, they tell you that it's become tiny, or that they've become impotent. To that, I tell them, how do you know if you haven't gone home and tried it?"
There's I just want to give a shout out to the people who have to transcribe this show. Have a good time.
Yes.
So God sorry.
Bless you guys.
Big penis shout out to those people.
Trish God McKinney, speed. Your turn, please.
Okay, so I have this morning, way up there on Google Trends was the name Pasha Grishuk. She is a former Olympic ice dancer who's now a businesswoman, and she apparently, according to sheriffs in Orange County, California, someone put the date rape drug in her drink at a hotel while she was at a business meeting. So she was sitting at the lounge of this restaurant and started to feel a little woozy and numb, and found a half dissolved pill at the bottom of her wine glass, and then they found more residue of a similar pill in another drink that she'd had. So nobody knows how that pill got in there, and you know, she's doing okay. It's just a kind of a crazy story. She was an Olympic gold medalist in ice dancing in 1994 and 1998.
Hmm. Thank you, Trisha. And Matt Martinez.
I have a story about the Google. It's all about the Google. I have one of the most emailed stories at npr.org right now. It's "Some Libraries Shun Google in Book Battle." It's a report by Kurt Nikisch, fine reporter from NPR station WBUR in Boston. Yeah.
I do. I know
him. Well, the story is all about the debate over who should control virtual libraries. And there's a fight a-brewing in Boston. Here's Kurt's report from there.
This fight is over free access to information.
This is the 1898 Palace to the People, as it was called at the time.
Maura Marks is in charge of digital services at the Boston Public Library.
And we're standing underneath the inscription over the central doorway, which says, "Free to all." Everything that is in this library is the property of the people of the city of Boston.
Now Marks wants to make it free to the people of the world. Her library is teaming up with 18 others to digitize the books in their collections that are no longer under copyright. The ambitious project will take years and millions of dollars. But just across the Charles River, Harvard is taking a different tack. The university has teamed up with the commercial search engine Google. Associate Library Director Dale Flecker says the job was too big, even for his university, with its $35 billion endowment.
I'm not sure we would have had the motivation to spend at the level that Google is willing to spend to do what they're doing. We don't know how much, they haven't said, but it is undoubtedly a lot of money.
The money comes with a catch. When Google finishes scanning a volume for Harvard, the book goes back on the shelves and the university gets a data file, but no one else does. So there's only one place for the public to read Harvard's books online. Okay, so I'm at yahoo.com, and I'm typing in the title of a book written by the president of Harvard, and the result, mostly just links to buy the book, no way to look inside. But if I go to Google, Confederate Nationalism, there it is.
"For the next generation to interface with the library through a single corporate entity, that's a huge problem."
That's Brewster Kahle. He heads the Internet Archive, a nonprofit that's working with 80 libraries across the country. It's giving them technical know-how to scan their books and make them available to every search engine, anyone really. Kahle says the cost comes to about $30 per book.
"Bringing this online is a tiny fraction of what it is we already spend for libraries, and we can multiply the access that we can offer just by this simple digitization process."
In a dim room inside the Boston Public Library, Rebecca Filio is scanning a leather-bound tome from the personal collection of John Adams. She's being careful with the fragile paper, slowing her routine of lifting a glass cradle, turning a page, and then easing the glass back down for cameras to take a picture.
I think this is my favorite part of the job. It's sort of rhythmic, as you can see, zen-like.
Paul Wynn is looking over Filio's shoulder. He He works for the Internet Archive and supervises the dozen people here who digitize books from 8 in the morning until midnight. Wynn says, on average, each worker scans a pair of pages every 4 seconds.
When all said and done, we're doing about 250,000 pages every single week. We're up to about 1,000 books.
Then the data goes online, and anyone can have at it. This open approach, though, relies on a hodgepodge of groups and volunteers to make it accessible to the public. The process goes much faster for those libraries that work with a corporate partner.
Let me find another book here.
Harvard librarian Dale Flecker is looking at one of his university's online volumes. Google's interface lists other books that reference the text, journal articles, too. There's even a map with every place name mentioned in the book.
This is a rich set of information that will get richer and richer with time. If you've got the full text of lots of books and some smart software engineers, there's an awful lot of new things that you can do.
Google is also taking Harvard further than most libraries feel comfortable going on their own, by scanning books that are still under copyright. The head of Google's book search, Adam Smith, says his company is out to make a profit, but its business model is right in line with the mission of its partner libraries at Harvard, Stanford, the New York Public Library, and others.
People are interested not just in searching web pages, but in searching all the world's information. And so this initiative plays directly into that in really enhancing the quality of the overall search experience for Google users.
Smith says his company has no plans to charge for access to the books it scans, but that's the least of Brewster Kahle's concerns. The founder of the Internet Archive worries that a corporation beholden to advertisers could be compelled to block access to a controversial book, say, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Imagine having a single organization have to respond when somebody puts pressure on them to take a set of works off the shelves. And if it's only available from one organization, you'd never know it.
Google's Adam Smith calls those fears overblown. Besides, he says, his company's agreement with partner libraries is not exclusive. So Smith says if Harvard one day decides to make its books accessible to any search engine, there's nothing stopping it. Librarians can always go back to the shelves, empty them onto carts, and scan the books again on their own.
That was reporter Kurt Nickisch reporting from Boston. You can get a link to this and all the stories you heard on the most at our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.